Well, as Howard rightly said, I have devoted many, many years of research to trying to understand where Wittgenstein came from. Wittgenstein himself said very little about this in his philosophical writing. The vast majority of which he never published anything. So we were really puzzled when I started working at Wittgenstein in 1964. It was as though he fell out of the sky. And I began, as an historian of philosophy, trying to figure out where can you work, how can you fit Wittgenstein in? Well, for a long time, that was sort of touch and go. We didn't really know how to make much sense out of that. Though there were a lot of efforts to be made. One very important text, which appeared in 1977, in the work which is translated as Culture and Value, and which Alois Pichler has re-edited, tells us, in Wittgenstein's own words, that he didn't see himself as being very original. I talked about that text at great length last year. And that he lists 10 people who influenced his thought. And one of these people, in 1977, it was a shock. It was a traumatic shock, really. It was Oswald Spengler. Spengler was thought to represent everything that Wittgenstein and sensible people rejected. And people were very surprised that he listed Spengler. In what follows, I've tried to make some sense out of what Wittgenstein took over from Spengler. What I don't talk about very much is how he did it, and that's probably the most interesting aspect of the whole business. But it nevertheless is mind-boggling how many themes there are in Spengler which you find later in Wittgenstein. Now, the idea for doing this research didn't, again, fall out of the sky. Rudolf Haller, my colleague in Austria, and a Swiss philosopher by the name of Raphael Ferber have raised some questions about how Spengler's views of morphology and how his views of language influenced Wittgenstein. And I want to explore these, talk about these a little bit, and to go beyond that to try and give you a basic picture of how Wittgenstein's later philosophy is, in many respects, emerging from Spengler. So I want to start with the whole question, the point about mentioned Kenntnis from part two of the Philosophical Investigations, a text which is very often quoted and has been very often quoted, especially here in connection with discussions of aesthetics. And the view that Wittgenstein puts forward there is that there is a form of knowledge, mentioned Kenntnis, that cannot be expressed in propositions. He puts himself this way. Fortunately, you don't have simply to hear me. You can follow that, I think, assuming I can do it. Yeah. Is there expert judgment about the authenticity of expressions in Friedman? Even here, there are people with better and worse judgment. Generally, more correct prognoses proceed from the judgment of those with better knowledge of human nature. That's how I translate Menschenkenntnis, knowledge of human nature. Can knowledge of human nature be learned? Yes. Some people can learn it, but not from a course in instruction, rather through experience. Can another person be a teacher in this matter? Certainly, from time to time. He gives him the right tip. Wink is the word. It's a favorite word of Frege's, by the way. This is what learning and teaching look like here. What one learns is not a technique. One learns correct judgments. There are rules also, but they do not form a system, and only people with experience can apply them correctly, unlike the rules of calculation. End of the quote. Wittgenstein terms the basis of judgment in personal matters, such as the authenticity of feelings, imponderable, unwägbare evidence, evidence which cannot be systematically subjected to detached assessment. Learning to make judgments on its grounds is a subjective matter of getting a knack for something. For example, having an eye for painting. Blick is the German word. Spengler uses it's also the word that Wittgenstein uses. This is tantamount to recognizing the significance of glances, gestures, tones of voice as stimuli to and indices of understanding other people's feelings. So Wittgenstein is clearly endorsing a notion with significant similarities to Michael Polanyi's idea of tacit knowing, a more primitive personal form of knowledge than propositional or formal knowledge. And it's precisely in defending the primacy of practical knowledge over theoretical knowledge that Wittgenstein bids farewell to logical positivism and to conventional analytic philosophy, though not necessarily to a kind of philosophical analysis. The dramatic character of that break cannot be overestimated. As it turns out, there is indeed in Wittgenstein's mature philosophizing a kind of genuine knowledge that cannot be said, but only be shown. This is the point of Wittgenstein asking himself rhetorically later in Uncertainty whether or not he was getting closer and closer to the idea that logic cannot be described. You simply must look at the practice of language, how we use language. In philosophy, we can at best use language to gesture at the role of action in determining meaning. Wittgenstein's indebtedness to Spengler here is no less profound than his break with conventional analytic philosophy. It is dramatic, for in fact, the tacit character of human knowledge is a central theme in Spengler's Decline of the West, as it's conventionally called, the Untergang des Abendlandes. Scattered throughout Spengler's chef d'oeuvre, from beginning to end, we find a discussion of a kind of knowledge typically expressed by statesmen, experienced animal lovers, people who know each other intimately, such as long married couples, gamblers, these are all just examples. Astonishingly, but nevertheless credibly under certain circumstances, even animals. Interesting, since nowadays there's such an interest in animals. And this involves a profound sensitivity to the peculiarities of individuals and an intuitive recognition of the meaning of situations. Again, something Spengler emphasized. Spengler characterizes knowledge of people as deep, wordless understanding, arising from our experience of people as opposed to nature. A mere glance suffices someone who really understands people to size up what's going on, what they think, what they feel. That's what's at stake here. A mention kenner has a firm grasp of what Spengler terms the Takt des Werdens, literally the measure, the musical sense of becoming, the pulse of developments, so it's something dynamic. Where another sees a random succession of happenings, the mention kenner sees the Gestalt, or in Spengler's terms, the physiognomy of a situation in all its uniqueness. It's something that the humanities, since Dilthey's time, have been trying to figure out how to grasp. The individuality of an object in art, one talks with, one often uses the term from Walter Benjamin, aura, to describe this. Mensch and Kenner are adept at perceiving crucial differences, especially as regards the timing of their interventions in the world. Moreover, it's typical of those who lack Menschenkenntnis that they generalize too quickly. Wittgenstein always condemned that. Finally, Menschenkenner do not explicitly know what they know in the sense of being able to talk about it or give an account of it. But that doesn't hinder them from acting with certainty and security. I mean, these are all points that are explicitly made in Spengler's Decline of the West. In sum, there's little doubt that Wittgenstein's discussion of Menschenkenntnis is heavily indebted to Spengler. However, we can get a better notion of the importance of this connection between Wittgenstein and Spengler. If we examine the context, again, from the same part of the Philosophical Investigations, Part 2, Section 11, in which Wittgenstein talks about aspect seeing and the famous duck rabbit. Coming to the second point slowly. I suppose I don't need to remind anybody about the whole business about aspect seeing. It's the part of Wittgenstein's work which has been most interesting to people from outside the analytic tradition, to the continent, so-called continental tradition. Now, it's often thought one should make a bridge between Wittgenstein and people like Heidegger with respect to perspectivism. But the odd thing is, when Wittgenstein's talking about the duck rabbit, he doesn't emphasize, he doesn't focus on the fact that two perspectives are involved. That's part of it. That's an essential part of it. But that's not his main point. His main point is another one that's often overlooked in the literature. I mean, what fascinates Wittgenstein here is our relationship to the two. Not simply the fact that there are two aspects, but that we have a different relationship to these two aspects. And this is the Spenglerian point. The aspect that we're used to is something that we can simply report upon, we can describe. Whereas the aspect that dawns upon us and surprises us, I wonder if I have a duck rabbit, so I guess I don't. The aspect that dawns upon us surprises us, and it produces a reaction in us that is what Arthur Koestler called an aha experience. In a passage reminiscent of Spengler, Wittgenstein says that seeing a new aspect is a matter of physiognomy. We suddenly recognize a new intelligible unity, metaphorically a face, where we previously conceived some commonplace object that wasn't worth thinking about twice. The surprised reaction, he says, it's involuntary. It's an involuntary reaction. It's a primitive one that involves instinctive behavior. But as a matter of sudden recognition, it clearly involves thinking and is something more than mere perception. So he's contrasting the commonplace experience of my looking at Alois Pinkler and seeing him as I've seen him for many, many years, and then perhaps looking at his little son, Leo, and seeing a similarity there. That's a discovery, and there's a connection going on there, and that's something that we delight in. And this emotional reaction, if you like, is what interests Wittgenstein. And what Wittgenstein wants to go on to say, this is going to tell us something important about language, about the language of description, and about what's embedded in the language of description. The point is that we refer to the two aspects that we can see in different speech acts. The one we usually see is perceived and reported upon, is described, whereas the aspect that dawns upon us more or less forces an exclamation out of us, upon recognition of the surprising form. That exclamation is attended upon a new thought that the second aspect presents. It's not simply a report, but an expression of a feeling associated with a surprise. The sudden thought of a rabbit where I've only seen a duck has done something unusual to me, and I express my experience of that new paradigm for seeing, you could call it, and explain, a rabbit, not simply a rabbit. This is the kind of little difference that Wittgenstein claims makes a difference. This is very important. A form of thinking which is not logical in the strict sense is involved, for there are no surprises in logic. Wittgenstein said that again and again and again his whole life long. There are no surprises in logic. and the philosophical importance of that surprise is that it shows us how it is that our familiar experiences are more complicated than we think they are. He says in the Philosophical Investigations, when he's talking about philosophy, it's the familiarity, it's the everyday character, it's almost a passage very reminiscent of Heidegger, it's the everyday character of things that leads us to overlook important nuances that are crucial for philosophy, that are not particularly important in practical life. And he's trying to create, as a philosopher, he has to create a new tension between the everyday and the philosophical, and which explains his style to a great extent. Wittgenstein points here to the similarity between the expression of surprise and the expression of pain, which is in the utterance. I am in pain. So, neither is a report purely and simply. The point is that not one but two functions of language are involved in aspect seeing: reporting upon perception and expression of a surprise. And this brings us in turn to the heart of Wittgenstein's mature conception of language, the idea that it's not words alone that convey meaning, but that the ways that they are interwoven into our actions. It's this interweaving which makes the language game. And there are all sorts of language games. In this analysis, the distinction between language games of reporting and language games of expression is absolutely in the center. And it's the distinction which has a prominent place in Spengler's view of language. Spengler builds up a strong case, which I don't think I'm going to go into for the sake of time, precisely around this point. There's a difference between language as expression of something and language as communication, Ausdruck and Mitteilung. And it's central to Spengler that these two forms of language are different, but they can't be easily disentangled from one another. What happens historically, and here's a point that Wittgenstein seems to agree with, but it's not the kind of thing that was particularly interesting to him. It's very important for Spengler. It says, in the course of becoming civilized, practice becomes swallowed up by theory. Culture petrifies, as it were, turns to stone. Culture, in the literal sense of what's grown up organically, so the Latin cultus, becomes paralyzed. This is Spengler's word, paralyzed. A technocratic, formalistic Mandarin mentality emerges that conceives the whole of reality mechanistically. Thus, language ceases to be principally a means of communication and tends to become an ornament or a fetish. In Saussure's terms, langue increasingly becomes detached from parole. Schools and churches institutionalize the fetish. There's a strong critique of the school as an institution in Spengler. The effect is to make language as it is used incomprehensible to speakers. And remember the ancient Egyptian scribes who were among the inventors of language, I mean, were a caste unto themselves, protecting language, protecting written language. Only the Mandarins can now understand it. They systematically forget the more primitive, expressive function of words. They come to worship truth as the basis of communication. This dichotomy, which, by the way, owes a great deal to Schopenhauer's dichotomy between the world as will, the world as representation, is a far cry from anything we find in Wittgenstein, except by suggestion. The whole business about the rejection of theory in Wittgenstein is very closely related to it. In the end, Wittgenstein agrees that in the process of becoming civilized, we've lost sight of the primitive functions of language the almost animal functions of language, I've said in another case, that underlie our sophisticated techniques of representation. So he writes in Uncertainty, "I want to regard humans here as animals, as a primitive being to which we grant instinct but not reasoning, as a creature in a primitive state. Any logic good enough for a primitive means of communication suffices. We do not need to be ashamed of it. Language did not emerge from the process of reasoning." This has to be strange stuff for logical positivists, but it's absolutely central to Spengler, who believed that our humanity has in fact been grafted onto our animal nature. Okay. And in a very interesting passage, that Raphael Faber, who was the first one really to make the point that Wittgenstein's view of language, this very central notion, is indebted to Spengler. Spengler says, you know, if you want to understand what language is all about, you ought to look at a hunter and how a hunter deals with his dog. And he said, the dog follows a finger which has been stretched out before it. It listens attentively to the sounds of words and shakes its head. It doesn't understand this kind of human language at all. Then it produces a few sentences in order to indicate its conception. It stands still and barks back. He says, that's a sentence in its language which contains the question whether the master perhaps meant this or that. There then follows the joy, similarly expressed in dog language, if it grasps that it understood rightly. Spengler goes on to say, if a country parson explains something to a peasant woman, he takes a hard look at her and involuntarily puts everything that she cannot understand in her language, or in the church's mode of expression, into his gestures. Today's word languages altogether can only lead to communication in connection with other forms of language, separated from this more primitive language in which gesture is of the utmost importance. Spengler believes there's a common behavioral language that underlies all communication and, as we've seen, even between people and animals, that's somehow implicit in spoken language. So, whereas Wittgenstein will speak of the common behavior of mankind as the common form of acting, as the frame of reference by means of which we interpret a foreign language, so Spengler will emphasize this common behavioral language. Here again, there's an important difference, of course, between them. Wittgenstein employs the example of what people, as opposed to dogs, do continually in the philosophical investigations to differentiate between the kinds of meaningful human action appropriate to animals that speak, people, and the behavior of animals that do not. I don't want to say there's a one-to-one relationship here, that would be absurd. But he asks rhetorically whether a dog is too honest to be able to stimulate pain, for example. In the passage in question, Spengler emphasizes that a child speaks this common behavioral language before it's mastered its first word, whereas Wittgenstein will insist that although we learn the most fundamental things we come to learn from experience, we do not learn them from our own experience, but from that of others. Moreover, Wittgenstein emphasizes that we first learn language by play, whereas Spengler insists that children discover, for example, what truth means by playing. For Wittgenstein, that playing has the character of Abrichtung, discipline, dressage, which is a term usually associated with training animals. In addition, this practical mode of learning by being disciplined terms that we do not explicitly know. The most important things we know them on the basis of experience. Thus Wittgenstein writes in Uncertainty, I did not get my picture of the world by satisfying myself of its correctness, nor do I have it because I'm satisfied of its correctness. No, it's the inherited background against which I judge between true and false. The propositions describing this world picture might be kind of a mythology, and their role is like that of rules of a game, and the game can be learned purely practically without learning any explicit rules. Uncertainty, 94-95. This lack of explicit knowledge is what determines the indirect character of Wittgenstein's method. But that's to run ahead. Indeed, Baker and Hacker insist that Wittgenstein's notion of language builds upon the Spenglerian notion of a homogeneous, spiritualized, well-ordered Weltbild that comprehends the totality of knowledge. In fact, Wittgenstein is describing the point where nature grows into culture, and that brings me back to our theme, something that's clearly continuous with Spengler. Baker and Hacker go so far as to suggest that Wittgenstein owes the much-discussed notion that meaning is to be explained ultimately in terms of forms of life to Spengler. I'm not so sure about that, but it's possible. On Spengler's view, the civilized spirit of formalizing, mechanizing, and systematizing everything has a way of blinding us to the behavioral origins of knowing as written language becomes a fetish. Thus, dazzled by the fetish, the sophisticated systematic philosopher seeks things that correspond to words, thereby overlooking the possibility that one word can stand for many, perhaps related but hardly identical things. For Spengler, as for Wittgenstein, a single term can refer to many different things. For example, Spengler will insist that there should be a discussion of three Aristotles, the Greek one, the Arabic one, the Gothic one, to do justice to all of the historical phenomena that fall under the rubric Aristotle. In order to see language in all its complexity from within civilization, we have to develop a method for inducing skepticism about the comfortable certainties upon which modern thought is based, including the idea that there is such a thing as language. I mean, this is what Spengler is opposed to, like Wittgenstein. For Spengler, this means doing battle with the mechanistic spirit of systematic thought, the tendency to generalization and the pursuit of causal explanations. Spengler polemicizes dramatically in several places against causal explanation in philosophy. Now, Spengler calls, I come to my third point, which bears upon the morphological method. Philosophy is a matter of describing physiognomies. This physiognomy is what Spengler calls his method. His aim is to do justice to human history on the basis of a strict and clear physiognomy, these are his words, that is completely conscious of its resources and its limits. Very Wittgensteinian thought, page 142. In the De TV edition of Spengler. Its method is attributed to Goethe's botanical studies, and Spengler says all the time, all I'm doing here is saying what Goethe would have said if Goethe were a philosopher alive today. At this point, I want to add something which is not in my original paper. First of all, by quoting Goethe, as who is being quoted also by Spengler, because it also illuminates Wittgenstein as well. Goethe says, "The urge to cognize living forms as such and grasp their outwardly visible and tangible parts contextually, and to take them as imitations of what is inward and so master to some degree the whole in an intuition has always arisen in science. The idea to see things together, it's a Wittgensteinian metaphor, is something which both Goethe and Spengler, following him, appreciate very much. They see this also as connected with basic aesthetic impulses. In effect, representing living nature, say the nature of a leaf, for Goethe, is not the matter of representing a single thing, but representing a progression within a series of gestalts all at once. And Goethe tried to develop ways of doing this visually. So I'll give you an example of what Goethe terms a graded dynamic series. In understanding the relation to the idea that a leaf is not one thing that you can define, but a family of things, Goethe makes these kind of representations here, where at one glance you can see the relationship between this thing here, which looks not at all like that over there, but you can see them as part of one set of development. Goethe's botanical studies are based upon the capacity to represent visually at one go something whose perception involves discrimination, making judgments, practical thinking. The only philosopher who's really picked this up in the 20th century is Hans Kassirer, whose work has not been integrated into anything, much to the embarrassment of the philosophical community, on my view. This is behind Spengler. It's something that Goethe, that Wittgenstein picked up in all sorts of different ways, coming from Goethe's morphology of plants, since it is hardly ever discussed in connection with Wittgenstein. I wanted to mention it here. And I mean, this is what physiognomy is all about. In the end, it's a matter of describing and making judgments about analogies. The perspective of physiognomy originates in sensitivity to style and to form as they exist in individual cases. It's a matter of understanding individual cases and the analogies which bind these individuals together. So understanding what's similar but not identical. The physiognomic perspective is developmental, as I've said. The physiognomist is always sensitive to the Takt des Werdens. Movement, as Spengler says, it is only an embarrassment to the thinking man. But it's something obviously to somebody who takes a look. Wittgenstein's locution there. Obvious to somebody who takes a look. So with respect to language, physiognomic knowledge proceeds from melodies, rhythms, emphasis, color, and gesture, all of which are part and parcel of use. To employ terms that are not Spengler's, but nevertheless appropriate for all that, physiognomic understanding is much more a grasp of pragmatics than it is of semantics or syntax. Understanding language is grasping usage and not a set of formal structures underlying it. As such, physiognomic understanding is historical and aims at preserving differences. Now, this is all interesting for all kinds of reasons. Among other things, I think because the explicitly skeptical dimension of Spengler's physiognomy vis-a-vis classical philosophy attaches to his battle against this spirit of the system. The skepticism that Cavell and others have attributed to Wittgenstein, I think, is to a great extent a matter of his Spenglerian heritage. Something that's also true, by the way, of Wittgenstein's historicism. I mean, something that is present as a subtext rather than explicitly discussed, but nevertheless there in Wittgenstein's on Wittgenstein's view of meaning. Both Wittgenstein and Spengler want to undermine systematics philosophy in terms of its universalistic ahistorical claims about knowledge and society. And both of them want to do it on the basis of a comparative perspective which shows that the systematizer's claims to universality are unfounded, and that on the basis of culturally given multiplicity. The aim of Spengler's physiognomy is to remind us about the importance of nuances and minutiae that in fact amount to big differences when we're trying to understand language and ultimately human reality. Thus, Spengler will compare his task to that of a portrait painter. Quote, describing, fashioning physiognomy as the art of portraiture carried over into the realm of the intellectual, end of quote, is therefore profoundly descriptive rather than an explanatory enterprise. A certain similarity with Wittgenstein's self-description as a landscape artist, beginning at the preface of the Philosophical Investigations, suggests itself here. Moreover, Spengler insists that the Ursymbole, determining the collective ideals that distinguish cultures from one another, are determined by a collective experience of space in the form of landscape. I think it should be relatively clear that the step from Spengler to Wittgenstein here is not particularly great. I mean, Wittgenstein's central notion that description must replace explanation within philosophy, as well as the scandalous idea that philosophy simply describes the world, leaving everything as it is, comes to fit into place. At least one sees that, that Wittgenstein didn't invent this idea, and that it has a broader context, to go back to that notion. The same is true of the notion that we simply need to take a look at how things stand, but that we're tempted to speculate rather than look. And that's something that's part of this, an essential part of the story for both Wittgenstein and for Spengler. Indeed, the whole enterprise of philosophizing against the spirit of the system, as Wittgenstein does, is perfectly sensible for a Spenglerian. And it's been the burden of the previous discussion here for understanding people, for understanding language and the physiognomy to show that Wittgenstein did accept central Spenglerian notions and did build his mature philosophy on them. Okay, I want now to if I have a few minutes, just to mention a few points in texts where you see a clearly Spenglerian idea turning up. Now, there's a point in the Philosophical Investigations where, in the discussion of philosophy, and that's what I'm concerned with, the chapter on philosophy, in the very, very important, perhaps most crucial paragraph in that discussion, paragraph 109 of part 1, where Wittgenstein suddenly tosses off the phrase, die pneumatische Auffassung des Denkens. This answer, translate this as thought as a gaseous medium. I have never seen anybody who's ever been able to make any sense out of it, because the translation is completely wrong. If you know Spengler, you know this word pneumatisch relates not simply to the notion of pneuma, breath, but it's something that's related to the Magian, which is to say Jewish, Semitic, Jewish Arabic, Arabic culture. And it's something that's essentially associated with that culture. So you might translate it so as magic, the idea of thought is something magical. And then it makes sense in that context. Well, I mean, that's a textual point. Another point, one of the things that Spengler says that Wittgenstein doesn't say, but could well have, because he doesn't put the matter quite this way. Spengler says, there's no such thing as mathematics. There are only ways of doing mathematics. Es gibt keine Mathematik, es gibt nur Mathematiken, plural. And this is, it's, I mean, it's not as though Wittgenstein needed Spengler to get to that view, but it's a view that they certainly both share. In all matters of aesthetics, I mean, when Wittgenstein comes to write about aesthetics in his lecture on aesthetics, the central thing in aesthetics is not how it is not necessarily how we define it. I mean, it's anything but the definition of words like beauty, intuition, or whatever. It starts with our reactions, human beings, how they react to aesthetic experiences. Kjellis Johannessen, the venerable Kjellis, has always said this is connected with our reactions to individual forms. This is a form of physiognomic knowledge, without having the slightest idea there's a connection here. But I mean, this is exactly what Spengler says. I mean, in the end, the important thing is the reaction, and the aesthetic language is built up around trying to formulate the right gesture in words to react to an object of art, to react to something we experience, or to a landscape. In the lectures and conversations, there's a passage that seems to come out of nowhere, where Wittgenstein says, suddenly, it's not quite clear really how it's connected with the rest of the discussion, what it has to do with the study. He says, think about Darwin. Nobody thought nobody paid much attention to his arguments or anything. Everybody was for Darwin or against Darwin. Well, as it turns out, one of his teachers, his first real teacher in philosophy, Ludwig Boltzmann, was an enthusiastic Darwinist. Spengler hated Darwin, and he thought Darwin was responsible for everything that was more or less wrong in modern culture. So Spengler says he denounces Darwin as a mechanist, as a materialist, as a socialist, as English, as a Manchesterian, as a Malthusian, as a superficial caricature of the true understanding of race and history, and above all, as an enemy of Goethe's, which I don't think Darwin was. But I mean, Spengler never takes a chance to never passes up a chance to downgrade Darwin. There's another point. This, again, at the anecdotal level, when Stephen Tolman and I were writing Wittgenstein's Vienna, Stephen said we were talking about Wittgenstein's relation to philosophy in Cambridge, and Stephen quoted Wittgenstein as saying the following: "Poor Broad, he thinks that philosophy is the physics of the mind." Well, you find in many places exactly this notion in Spengler. I'll just give you one particular quote. "Wanting to hang on to an exact knowledge of the eternally mysterious soul is senseless. However, the drive to think abstractly compels the physicists of the internal world, nevertheless, to explain an illusory world of representations and concepts on the basis of newer and newer representations and concepts." Something that Wittgenstein could easily have read. Now, what I've tried to do here is to give you some examples of parallels. What I haven't done, and as I say, which is really the most important part, is to explain where the differences are. I just made some gestures in that direction. I mean, if you want to understand Wittgenstein, it's not simply a matter of understanding the similarities, but for anybody for that matter, the important thing about any comparison are the points of difference. And there are many. How does Wittgenstein reach Spengler? How does he pick this stuff? How do these ideas come into his work? I mean, that's an open question for the future. But in any case, Spengler gives you some idea of that the philosophical investigations, contrary to what Georg Henry von Richard wrote when they appeared, that they are not completely original. In fact, as Wittgenstein himself said, The substance of the thoughts, not the way they were developed, but the substance of the thoughts, are things that he got elsewhere. So